Now Rousseau was undoubtedly a man of the Enlightenment, but he went beyond the Enlightenment, and that is what gave him stature and importance. Rousseau believed, without doubt, in the power of reason, but he was also imbued with the corruption of the present age, much more imbued with the corruption of the present age than, let us say, Voltaire. It must be clear from your reading of the Confessions that Rousseau searched for truth almost obsessively. Truth both about man and his society, as well as about himself. As he puts it in the Confessions, what I have promised to relate is the history of my soul. The Confessions will become standard reading for generations into the 19th century, and it will produce among many intellectuals an outpouring of feelings in imitation of Rousseau, in letters, in autobiographies. In fact, the Confessions will start a new kind of fad, a new kind of literary genre of the revelation of one's soul in public or to one's friends. Now, where then is the truth to be found? As a generalization, it is to be found in the genuine, but again, what is the genuine? Rousseau's definition of the genuine in the Confessions was again to inspire the reaction against the Enlightenment. For reading the Confessions, many people believed, with some justice, that the genuine for Rousseau was that which is closest to human nature, was that which is least artificial, was, in the last resort, that which is least intellectualized. In the Confessions, and I think that cannot be denied, he arrives at this kind of, almost you might say, worship of nature. As he puts it at one point, "The remainder of the day I buried myself in the forest, where I sought and found the picture of those primitive times of which I boldly sketched the history. I demolished the pitiful lies of mankind. I dared to expose their nature in all its nakedness, to follow the progress of time and of the things which have disfigured this nature, and comparing man has made him, with natural man, I showed him in his pretended perfection the true source of his own misery." Now, from a passage like that, it might seem that Rousseau was indeed exalting the primitive because it is close to nature. But it is also clear from this passage that nature is genuine only in contrast to what man has made of himself. It's quite clear that nature is in a way the foil to man, that nature's genuineness is only genuine in a sense in contrast to what man has made of himself. Does this then lead to the worship of nature and innocence, as you have in the end of the perfection of the Confessions, to the worship of nature and innocence? "I can think," he says, "of no worthier homage to divinity than the mute admiration which is aroused by the contemplation of his works," which means nature, of course, "and does not find expression in outward acts. I can understand how it is that the inhabitants of cities, who see nothing but walls, streets, and crimes, have so little religious belief." In other words, a passage like that can also lead to the exaltation of the worship of nature and innocence. And indeed, many who read the Confessions thought this was Rousseau. And in their reaction to the Enlightenment, which they shared apparently with the Confession, taking these passages about nature, these passages against the city, these passages which make nature a foil against what man has made of himself, taking all of these, began to worship a certain primitivism, the great cult of the shepherd and the shepherdess, the resurrection of the Arcadia, which had always existed in literature, that is, the exaltation of primitive rural life, which had always existed in Western literature. And then you get it in the level of the more absurd, such as Louis XIV, XVI, and Marie Antoinette building a village behind Le Petit Trianon, which you can still see outside Versailles, and playing themselves shepherd and shepherdess in this village. Now, this interpretation of the return to nature and to innocence, this is one interpretation. But on the other hand, Rousseau does say that man is man only in society. And he makes that point as well in the Confessions, which is not totally about nature and the return to innocence. As he puts it in the Confessions, the justice and uselessness of my complaints left in my mind the seeds of indignation against our foolish civil institutions, whereby the real welfare of the public and true justice are always sacrificed to an apparent order, which is in reality subversive of all order, and of which the only effect is to bestow the sanction of public authority upon the oppression of the weak and the injustices of the strong. From this passage, it is clear again that Rousseau is not against order itself. He is opposed to the false order which is suppression, the kind of order that existed, he thought, at the time. For this order means, in fact, an abuse of man's faculties, of the faculties of man. As he says again in the Confessions, Providence is acquitted of responsibility in regard to every single one, and that they all have their origin in man's abuse of his faculties rather than in the nature of things themselves. So that Rousseau is not for chaos against order. His criticism is that there is now a perverted order, and his essential criticism of this perverted order is the abuse of man's faculties that is involved in this perverted order. For Rousseau believed that man has a natural goodness, which he at times in the Confession equates with the passions. Seems directly at times, if you read the Confessions, opposed to the pragmatism and reason of the Enlightenment. But there again, when he criticizes his mistress, Madame de Menthon, for listening to her reason, when she should have listened to her heart, instead of listening to her heart, which always guided her aright, she listened to her reason, which guided her wrong. What Rousseau means is that the heart, the passions, are part of the totality of man. But for Rousseau, the reason are also part of this totality of man. And his accusation of the philosophers was that they had rent asunder the reason and the passions. For reason, for Rousseau, was not the building of dogmas and system. Reason, for Rousseau, was a method of comprehension. Indeed, he at times equates it with man's conscience. It was a matter of comprehension, but it was part of the totality of man and must not be sundered from the passions, because then it becomes indeed a system. Now, as he said in Emile, conscience is to the soul what instincts are to the body. The body cannot live without instincts, so the soul cannot live without conscience. In all of this, he undoubtedly assumed the perfect ability of man, an optimism which takes in this time not only reason, but takes in the entire man himself. This again you can see in the book that subsequent generations did not read much, his Social Contract. His Social Contract that was written specifically for the city-state of Geneva. In the Social Contract, let me remind you, all men govern each other by common consent. There is government by the general will, that is, by the common consent of all. And Rousseau believed that this common consent will lead to consensus. For the society in which this will take place, the small-scale city-state of Geneva, the perfectibility of man will be able to realize itself. And realizing itself and taking in the reasons and the passions, a consensus of the good will emerge. And yet again, this society of the Social Contract was no chaos. It was again disciplined. It had what Rousseau would have called the right kind of order instead of the wrong kind of order. There was complete self-government through consensus, but there's also a legislator who prepares legislation. It is not a chaotic society. It is a society not of parliaments, but of direct democracy, based on this theory of human nature, but disciplined because there is the legislator who prepares the legislation. We can say this. Rousseau threw the concept of popular sovereignty into the discussion. Because of his optimism about man's reason and passions, which contrasts with his pessimism about existing society. From Rousseau on, the concept of the people will for the first time be thrown into the discussion, because for Rousseau, the people is a theoretical entity for the first time, really, an optimistic theoretical entity, which contrasts, if left free to unfold, with existing society. It is clear that Rousseau is more optimistic here than Voltaire, that Rousseau is not the kind of elitist. For Voltaire, the mass of men are locked in their superstition. But Rousseau advocates a break with the present rather than change through influencing the governing establishment. A break with the present which will substitute genuine order for false order and therefore will let man develop his perfect ability, which includes the passions as well as reason, which in turn will make for a consensus which will make direct democracy possible. But remember, in the small form of the city-state of Geneva, for which he wrote the Social Contract. But we must go one step further. The Social Contract is not chaos, but Rousseau also has another device for establishing the consensus. For he, in a way, faced the accusation, what if the perfectibility of man is set back? What if there are setbacks? What if there are relapses in this direct democracy? And above all, Rousseau felt that when he had to make a constitution for a bigger unit, namely for Poland, paper constitution, of course, never got into fact, for Poland. And he had to think about another device to help man along in this path through virtue. And here he went back to the ancients, typically Enlightenment, to Sparta to find the method. The method he found was the method of public festivals. Public festivals as a means for uplifting public and private morals. Public festivals in the open air, so that the people communing directly with nature will be rejuvenated and will get new inspiration, as it were, for virtue. As he puts it, and I quote, "It is in the open air, beneath the sky, that you must assemble and give yourself up to the sweet sentiment of your happiness." Notice here again, it is in the open sky that you must assemble and give yourself up to the sweet sentiment of happiness. Notice the connection with nature, which will rejuvenate man's virtues, a connection you also have made in the confessions. Among the people where the great passions only speak at intervals, the sentiments of nature make themselves felt more frequently heard. In the higher ranks, they are absolutely stifled, and under the mark of sentiment, it is only interest or vanity that speaks. In other words, the people must rejuvenate themselves in contact with nature. Nature, which is always a first cause. Nature that is lifted out into the eternal. And the rejuvenation with nature is therefore a rejuvenation of the internal, a rejuvenation through God. But notice, God is not here the watchmaker that he is for Voltaire. But instead, nature is the genuine, the eternal, removed from corrupt society, rejuvenating that society which is not corrupt. Nature isn't captured. Nature stands outside the corruption. It is not, therefore, the automatic, watchmaker-like nature. It will lead, partly mistakenly, to a romantic concept of wild nature as over against ordered and systematic society. It will lead, in the end, to the worship in the 19th century of the wild landscape and wild nature as over against the rigidly ordered and disciplined landscapes of the 18th century, such as you have with the gardens of Versailles, for example. Nevertheless, that is again an exaggerated consequence from Rousseau, because nature did not induce chaos. Nature did induce the right order, the order of direct democracy, a disciplined direct democracy. Nature was rejuvenation, but nature was not pure chaos, as so much of the romantics then thought. The ideal state is based on the people, and festivals will make them love the state, love the collectivity, for that collectivity is, by definition, virtuous. Once again, this becomes important. Festivals become an integral part of the symbolism of the state. From the beginning, direct democracy is therefore associated with public festivals of a virtue. It is such that Robespierre was going to take up. When Robespierre put into the Tuileries garden the goddess of reason to be worshipped, he realized, which is implicit in Rousseau, that public festivals become the symbol, the objectification of a collectivity that is necessarily vague and general. Indeed, with the French Revolution and before, public festivals take the place of Christian liturgy and direct the allegiance of men not to the symbols of Christianity, but to the symbols of the revolution. In church, the goddess of liberty and the goddess of reason occupied the niche once occupied by the Virgin Mary. The liturgy and the responses were adopted for the festivals of the Republic as they had been for the festivals of Christianity. Festivals, public festivals, therefore become in a sense set. They come to have a function which was not quite Rousseau's function. They come to have the function in the end of the manipulation of mass movements. They come to have a function of social control. In the hands of Robespierre, festivals become a means of drawing the people to the regime and away from their old worships, Christianity, which were hostile for the regime. They become a means of manipulating public opinion through the substitution of new symbols for the old symbols of Christianity. Now, Rousseau had a political problem. Robespierre had a political problem. Rousseau wrote on paper, and paper is patient. Rousseau believed, really believed, that people were virtuous and that they could renew their virtue and there would be a consensus of virtue. He believed it. Robespierre, who faced an immediate situation, used the festival and made them into what they will remain until this day: the rituals, essential rituals, of political mass movements. Indeed, in this sense, Rousseau, with his founding of popular sovereignty, with his founding of the idea of the people as a concept, definite concept, with his idea of festivals, of the renewal of virtue, is indeed the founder of modern politics. He and Robespierre will indeed found modern politics. For whatever you say about modern politics, in reality they are the politics of mass movements. And what will count in modern politics is not so much representation, but ritual. What will count in the end are the rituals of mass movements, or you might say mass festivals, rituals. And here indeed, it is nothing original to say, because it was already true in the French Revolution, it is indeed something very banal to say that the medium is the message, because in modern mass politics, the medium is in fact the reality. And you cannot very well divorce the two anymore. Politics is and always has been manipulation. And mass politics meant mass manipulation through festivals, through the device that Rousseau started with something quite different in view, with in view indeed of a republic of virtue, but an idea which was taken and became, as I say, a means of mass control. For Rousseau believed in the natural virtue of man, let us remember, which would come out in communication with the one thing that is not corrupt by our society, nature. That is the only, for Rousseau, still true reflection of the divine. Everything else is corrupt, but you cannot corrupt the bee, and you cannot corrupt the weeping willow tree. But what that meant was that there was a correspondence between man and nature. And that correspondence was not, as with Voltaire, systematic, formalized in laws of nature through science. But it was indeed, one must say, an emotional correspondence which took in the whole man. When you went out under nature in a festival under the blue sky, as he describes it, you were not seeking to know the laws of nature. You were renewing yourself through God, by that which is eternally uncorruptible. In other words, by that which is internally the natural virtue. That, I think, you must be quite clear about. And if you do that, all of you, then there will be a consensus of a virtue. The optimism here is clear. Now Rousseau, in a way, was or has been called a judicious radical, and that is true. Rousseau believed in the legislator, as I have told you, in the social contract. He believed in order, not chaos, and a renewal of virtue. Nature was not chaos. Nature had a definite task. Nature was a whole, just as you as a whole. He knew, and this is quite clear in the Confessions, that he couldn't be a second Robinson Crusoe. That's why he was so much misread by people who sort of willfully misread him, because you will read in the Confessions that he says at one point, I know I can't be a second Robinson Crusoe who retreats on an island and just lives there. He knew that. His ideas were supposed to be ideas for present politics and present society. He did not live only, or did not mean to live, only in the imagination. And therefore, when you read your Rousseau, you must distinguish these levels. On a certain level, he'll tell you he's dreaming. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be on an island? Wouldn't it be wonderful to be alone in a wood? But in reality, he always immediately tells us, no, we have to construct a different society, because man is man only when he is in the society. And that is really our business. Though wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just withdraw? And this, of course, he said also in moments of despair. You must distinguish in the Confessions between moments of despair and more positive moments, when he puts forth concrete ideas. For Rousseau was a very volatile personality. But the next century, in its reaction against the Enlightenment, took the despair rather than the concrete. Rousseau's centrality for the reaction against the Enlightenment has obscured Rousseau's really concrete and positive ideas. The Romantics, for one thing, read only the Confessions and didn't read the Social Contract. In their reaction against system building and natural laws and all of that sort of thing, they came to believe in the passions as good, and they forgot Rousseau's ideal of comprehension, that reason is in fact comprehension. That plays into his educational ideas, which have also been misunderstood. For his ideal man, Emile, is educated first in nature. Quite right. The first thing, until he is about 8 years old, Emile isn't taught anything. He's just sent out to take walks in the wood, to communicate with nature. And the idea is very simple. Because Emile lives in present society, he must develop his virtue so he can withstand the later corruption. And the only way to do that is to avoid any kind of education which is bound to be as corrupt as a society until you have developed your virtue strong enough to be able to take it. And then Emile goes to school, and then he learns a great deal. But first he must develop, again, individually, as the people do as a whole, his virtue in connection with nature, untainted and uncorrupted, until, as it were, he is ready to face and withstand corrupt society. Again, Rousseau is not exalting here the return to innocence. This is a device in the present, given present conditions. But for the Romantics, it looked quite different. They took his opposition to system and clocks. Rousseau has these passages also, this dream that there be an end to time. And you will find that in the Confessions, which was to be one of the main dreams of the whole Romantic movement in the next century, that time have a still, that there be an end to time. You find that in Rousseau, but it is a dream. It is his world of dreams. It is not his world of reality. Moreover, the Romantics were impressed by something that is in Rousseau, that man and nature correspond, not just through natural laws, which you discover in the Cartesian manner, but that man and nature correspond in their totality, their comprehension as well as their passions. And as the Romantics believed in wild and impassionate nature, they made this a correspondent that only reinforced and corresponded to man's passion. For the Romantics, the great symbol of the correspondence between man and nature was the weeping willow tree, was the wild wood, was the craggy mountain landscape, and all of that. But for Rousseau, this was only in his dreams. The correspondence with nature is a correspondence of virtue and not merely a correspondence of sentiment. This, I think, is very important to remember. So if Rousseau was misread on the basis of the Confessions, it is always due, let me emphasize this, to the fact that he does not, or that people did not read into it, this distinction between the dream and the reality, and took the dream, that that generation was so opposed to the Enlightenment and rationalism and systems that it took the Confessions as a jump-off point into a flight from reality, into a flight for dreams. Sure, Rousseau fled into his dreams, but always to come out into what he thought was reality. Politically, Rousseau could also be adapted, as Robespierre did. Omitting the idealism, omitting the kind of potentiality of man under the right conditions. Certainly for Robespierre, the conditions were right. The revolution had taken place, after all. But still, the masses must be direct and controlled. Rousseau's idea of the virtue of the masses will revive. Not in the Romantic movement, who despised the masses, who paid no attention to this side of Rousseau on the whole, because the Romantics were an intellectual coterie. Not in Robespierre and the Republic of Virtue, which started the ritualistic form of mass movements. That will be revived in Marxism. It will be revived in the whole presupposition of Marxism. Namely, that the mass of men are redeemable, and under the right treatment, will be able to rule themselves in the general will. Let me remind you that Marx has no dictatorship of the proletariat after the revolution. That's Lenin. Lenin had no such illusions about the masses, far from it. But Marx believed that there was no need for a dictatorship of the proletariat after the revolution, because once the right conditions have come about, you will have a state where the general will reign, the consensus of virtue. Because, and here is a definite influence of Rousseau, a definite leaning of Rousseau, unalienated man will recapture his human nature. And the human nature, unalienated man will recapture once capitalism is over, Marx also described as a human nature of freedom, rationality, and happiness. And this belief, which in Marx will be fundamental, his presuppositions, everybody has presuppositions, his presuppositions in man as free, as able to be free, rational, and happy, are the presuppositions that also underlie Rousseau's general will and Rousseau's ideal of the people. But that will be taken both by Robespierre, by all mass movements, later by Lenin and the socialists, and will be changed into festivals as public manipulation, festivals as, this is the best way of putting it, as the liturgy of modern politics. And here I wish though we shall not go into this semester, you would think about it, because it is very important that what you have here, and even in the confessions and then in the French Revolution, is the beginning of modern politics. All modern politics will be mass politics. And rather than looking at the inessential of modern politics, the essential of modern politics will always be mass control and mass manipulation. And here the idea of festivals, you would call it perhaps mass meetings, you would call it your other liturgies, but everything is liturgized. The liturgy of mass movements, the liturgy of this sort of thing begins here, once at the same time that the idea of the people had been raised. For the first time, they come together. And here Rousseau is also central. The idea of popular sovereignty and the idea of festivals grow up in one man's mind together, in order to get around this problem that somehow you have to objectify, to make real to people, a general collectivity which is necessarily abstracted. You have to make it real. And you make it real through the goddess of reason. You make it real through the ideal Aryan type. You make it real through lots of things. Can't go into that now. Practically everything that has to do with politics is the objectification of this kind of collectivity, is collected with the idea of rituals. And of course, finally, that displaces Christianity. It is Christian rituals, but it displaces Christianity. From now on, all men will have two liturgies, not one. The liturgy of Christianity and the liturgy of mass politics. And sometimes they will, in a way, mesh, but the liturgy of mass politics is obviously based on the familiar and traditional liturgy of Christianity. Here again, no risk of just communicating with nature, no risk of just having a republic of virtue. Practical statesmen like Robespierre faced practical problems, and those problems were problems of mass manipulation. Now, all of this said, one thing Robespierre ignored, and in one thing he was at one with all the philosophers. He was not greatly interested in social or economic structures. Here he was a typical philosopher. All he says is there should be no extreme of riches and no extreme of poverty. But you won't find him much obsessed with social or economic structures. That again may have been his weakness. But on the other hand, the manipulation of mass politics does not immediately include this. It is concerned with myths and symbols. You can make out a case, far be it from me to make it out for you, you can contemplate it, that the real dray of mass politics is to find the correct myths. And if you found the correct myths, you've made it. And then match the right symbols to these myths, you have made it. And you can go almost, at least in European history, wherever you want. You have made it. So that you can say that Rousseau's contribution of myth and symbol as the liturgy of mass politics is for practical politics perhaps as important as there would have been an analysis of the social sphere or of economics, because that is what will be awfully important, to match the right myths to the right symbols. So I say, in mass politics, if you can do that, you really have it made. However, the mass politics is in itself a product of a changed social structure, because we haven't had it before the late 18th century, of a changed, much changed, and dynamic economic movement, because we haven't had this concern with the people before the end of the 18th century. So that from the philosophers, those comfortable intellectuals, well, if you read the Confessions, Rousseau lived quite a comfortable life, you know. He was always complaining about money, but remember that that is a relative thing. He wasn't as rich as Voltaire, but nor was he very poor either, in fact. So these philosophers living their comfortable life, all, of course, comfortable with their mistresses. Madame de Menthon, Voltaire went in for learned females. You know, his mistress was a famous mathematician who eventually died, to everybody's surprise, with ink all over her hand, writing a mathematical formula, which is a nice death for a woman, I think. However, all of this said, you know, I can't really satisfy you, you see. That's why I don't really try. I think I should. If I say woman is emotional and should be emotional, you know, then you hiss. If I say woman should be learned and die doing mathematical formula, you hiss too. But it is really quite beside the point, because I do not try to satisfy you on these grounds. History doesn't, really. Women remain emotional. And who, after all, carried the romantic movement, huh? I'd like to know. Who were the great and most romantics? Yes. Woman was now going into a phase of high emotion, swooning. All of this became, after all, very fashionable, as you will see next term, in the romantic movement. A whole new ideal of woman came up. Now, while Rousseau ignored the social and economic, as did all the philosophers, we, of course, cannot ignore it, because social and economic structures have changed and have, in a sense, made all of this possible. So that we must next Monday discuss, for one whole lecture, in fact, the changing economic and social structures on which the Enlightenment worked and then the French Revolution. Here I end again for any questions.